From London, BBC Caribbean Report.
The two grandmothers of Elian Gonzalez fly into New York to seek the six-year-old's return to Cuba. After Jesse Helms talks to the Security Council, UN diplomats call on the US to pay up. And is there too much talk and too little action in revamping the Windy Side?
It is time that we take pride out of our systems and understand that we could follow suit as to what even New Zealand, but more particularly Australia and South Africa are doing.
I'm Debbie Ransom and this is BBC Caribbean Report. The two grandmothers of Cuban shipwreck survivor Elian Gonzalez flew to the United States today. They arrived in New York by charter flight a short while ago, where they hoped to meet with Congressman Charles Rangel. He's been arguing for Elian to be returned home to his natural father. The six-year-old was rescued off the Florida coast after his mother and other Cuban migrants drowned at sea. Since then, he's been caught up in a high-profile custody battle between relatives in Miami and his father in Cuba. As Tom Gibb reports, Elian's grandmothers are flying into a similar political storm.
The two grandmothers left for New York, accompanied by leaders of the prominent church group, the U.S. Council of Churches. The grandmothers had said they would not go to the United States if it meant getting involved in legal or political disputes. But the church leaders were apparently able to persuade them that it would help their case. They will, according to a Cuban government statement, spend only a few days in the United States. During that time, they'll try to win over U.S. public opinion. They'll meet legislators and the U.S. authorities. They'll also ask the authorities to arrange a meeting with Elian to take place in New York. The Cuban statement said that the relatives in Miami have not allowed the father and grandparents to talk with Elian on the phone for several days. The visit will coincide with debates in the U.S. Congress, which reconvenes next week. Republican leaders want to pass a law making Elian a U.S. citizen. That would then end up on President Clinton's desk, leaving him a tough choice in the middle of an election campaign. The Democrats don't want that to happen. Members of Congress who favor sending Elian back to Cuba argue that images of the grandmothers putting their case directly and perhaps meeting Elian in New York could be crucial in swaying the debate.
Tom Gibb. Meanwhile, anti-Castro Congress members say they hope the bill to make Elian an American citizen could be ready by Tuesday. Caribbean and other United Nations delegates have been unanimous in calling on the United States to pay its outstanding contributions to the world body. Those calls come as part of the reaction to yesterday's appearance before the UN Security Council by American Senator Jesse Helms. He lectured the body on trying to impose authority on the US. Orrin Gordon looks at the ongoing reaction to Senator Helms, who spent a career criticizing UN waste and delaying America's payments. His report starts with the immediate response from two CARICOM UN diplomats.
There is a legal obligation on the part of each member state to pay its dues fully and in good time.
For Jamaica, this includes the payment of our assessed contributions in full, on time, and without conditions.
Jamaica's Security Council representative, their UN ambassador Patricia Durant, and before her Guyanese counterpart Rudy Insanelli. If what they said sounded uncannily similar, then consider this from the Malaysian ambassador Agan Hazmi. We fail to see why the United States can't do what we all do, pay our dues full and on time. And this from the Dutch ambassador Peter van Walsum. A member state cannot attach conditions to its willingness to pay. The arguments deployed against Senator Helms have a remarkable consistency about them. That's something the New York Times bureau chief Barbara Crosette agrees with.
Absolutely. It was very interesting. From Britain down to Jamaica and across to Asia and other parts of the world, certainly from Africa, people said it's become a mantra here, pay your dues on time and without conditions and in full. And this is what the message everyone delivered, if not in exactly those words, and some did use those words, then certainly in meaning.
The head of the powerful Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Senator Helms, has consistently held up the payment of America's UN dues. He thinks the UN wastes money and is one of its fiercest critics. He appeared before the Security Council at the invitation of the U.S. Ambassador Richard Holbrooke. And Barbara Crosset thinks he may be serving a purpose in American long-term aims to cut its contributions.
We are also headed here for a very important budget committee meeting at the United Nations where the U.S. is going to raise the question of lowering its percentage of assessment. And so it's in the talking shop stage everywhere among the U.N. missions because other countries are going to ask to pick up some slack so the U.S. can pay less.
That's not going to wash with Caribbean delegates, for one. Yes, they say the U.S. has by far the biggest contribution, but proportionately, they pay far more.
That report by Orin Gordon. Flights belonging to island hopping airline Liat resumed today as flight attendants returned to work. However, their return to the job only happened as union and airline officials agreed to all-day talks today. Leaders of the Antigua Workers Union and management of the financially strapped airline were still meeting up to airtime. The union wants Liat to settle the payment of January salaries. Just a reminder, you're listening to BBC Caribbean Report. Venezuela says it needs between $10 and $30 billion to repair the damage from last month's massive floods and landslides. The country's vice foreign minister, Jorge Valero, said the figures are astronomical because a substantial part of the national infrastructure has been destroyed. A large part of the Caribbean coastline of northern Venezuela was destroyed as mud and water avalanched down the mountain which separates Caracas from the Caribbean Sea. At least 10,000 people are believed to have died in the landslides. A further 100,000 have been left homeless.
Most of us love him. Nobody is perfect, you know. And we wish him well.
One of the thousands of fans who were in the streets of Brixton in South London today as boxer Mike Tyson arrived in the area. Local council leaders had warned the boxer not to visit Brixton as he was not welcome, but as our correspondent Adam Minot reports, that simply wasn't the case.
This is the reception Mike Tyson got in Brixton, the district of London where he was told he wasn't wanted. His walkabout never really happened. Hundreds of people, the vast majority black, had gathered and forced him to take refuge in Brixton Police Station. About half an hour later, he appeared at a window and shouted a few words to his followers. It was a special day for some who got close to him.
I was just coming round by the side of the police station and I saw a gap, so I thought, yeah, this is my chance to shake his hand, and he was just right there in front of me and I shook his hand and I hugged him.
Why, I asked others, was he such a hero?
The Lambert man who said Tyson is not welcome here. He should try to understand and know black people's feelings about Tyson before he put egg on his face this afternoon. So he's got egg all over his face now.
You don't object to the fact that he's a convicted rapist?
No, I don't think he did rape that girl. He didn't. He didn't rape the girl. He's just, excuse me, but it's a bit of sex went wrong.
If there are people in Brixton who didn't want him here, then they were nowhere to be seen this afternoon. Lloyd Hannigan, the former British boxing champion and friend of Tyson, said he was a special sort of hero to these people.
Mike asked me to organise today so he can come to Brixton, so I've organised it, got him down here, because he said he wanted to see the people, the real
that's
people.
Right.
The
real
people that support him, the common people.
Tyson abandoned his chance of walking through the streets of Brixton and went back to his hotel, he said, to continue with his training for the boxing match at the end of this month.
Adam Minot speaking from Brixton. Players on the West Indies under-19 team can be drafted into the senior team for the upcoming tours of the region by Zimbabwe and Pakistan. That's the view of the chairman of the West Indies selectors, Mike Finlay. And former West Indies bowler Colin Croft says leaving out many of those who were part of the New Zealand disaster is absolutely necessary. Both men were guests on a local radio program in Trinidad, and Tony Fraser was listening in.
Many times during last evening's discussion, there was sharp disagreement between selector Findlay and commentator Croft. But there was full agreement that those young batsmen who are doing so well in the World Youth Cup must be given an opportunity on the test team. Michael Findlay says yes and reveals that the selectors are hoping to have the West Indies board develop a camp over a period of a month where many of the young players will be brought together for training and understanding of the finer points of the game. He called names of those players who may be on the verge of test selection.
Hines and Marlon Samuels and Duna Ryan, these are some promising players who have played against the India. Hines and Duna Ryan have played against the India A team. Unfortunately, Marlon Samuels had a knee surgery, so he couldn't play in that series. But these are players who we have recognized with talent.
And while Colin Croft agreed with the approach outlined by the chairman of the selectors, he was unforgiving of the West Indies board. He says there has been too much talk and too little action on the fundamental restructuring of West Indies cricket.
Let me give you a statistic that many people don't understand, or maybe even know it and don't recognize it. 9 of the 11 players playing for Australia now came out of their academy. 9. Not 1 or 2, 9 of them. Now that tells me something, that they have a program that works. Now, Brian Lara said something in New Zealand that I don't even know if anybody in the Caribbean actually heard it. It is time that we take pride out of our systems and understand that we could follow suit as to what, even New Zealand, but more particularly Australia and South Africa are doing.
Both Finlay and Croft agreed that Brian Lara should remain as captain of the team. Croft says he should have been replaced after the South African series, but it's too late now to make a change. And without committing himself, Finlay says, the question is, who is there that can replace Lara at this point in time? Tony Fraser in Port of Spain for BBC Caribbean Report.
The superstars of reggae have been marking a special anniversary. The world's largest distributor of reggae music, VP Records, is celebrating its 20th anniversary. The New York-based company has some of the best-known reggae artists on its label. Leslie Goff reports.
It was hit songs like this one, Sitting and Watching, that helped VP Records become the biggest independent distributor of reggae music in the world. Randy Chin, vice president of VP Records, says he had a lot of fun digging through the company's hit list to create a 20th anniversary CD.
What we did, we went back one title per year for the last 20 years and picked out the best tracks that were being released on VP for the year. So it gives you a real flavor of sort of the evolution of the music in the last 20 years.
Do you take this man for your lawful husband?
In the past 20 years, VP has grown from a mom-and-pop retail business named after its husband and wife founders, Vincent and Patsy Chin, into a multifaceted company putting out 80 CDs a year. Randy Chin, who till recently worked in subsonic aerodynamics technology in California, says he always knew he'd continue the work his father started.
It's a milestone, obviously, for us. We've been doing this for a long time, and it actually really stretches back from the roots of the company, which is Randy's Records in Jamaica. It actually stretches back over 40 years. We're a Jamaican company doing reggae in the U.S., we've brought the music to a certain level within the U.S. and we want to continue to do that.
Would the casual listener learn something about how Jamaica, the country, has evolved in those 20 years by listening maybe to the production of the tracks?
I definitely think so. How the music has evolved, into a kind of a digital form, you can see that kind of start taking shape into, One of the big tracks we had about a year or two ago was the Beanie Man, Who Am I?
I guess somebody might say, if you were just to listen to this CD, you'd think that society has become much harsher, much more aggressive than perhaps it once was.
I mean, that's an interesting angle to look at it. I really wasn't looking at it that way in particular. But I suppose if you really look at the tracks and kind of study sort of the lyrics and to see what was popular at that time, you could see that evolution take place.
Watch it now, murdering people again. Watch it now, 12 parts people then. Lottie daddy, we love the party. We don't cause trouble and we don't bother nobody.
So what now for VP Records? Andy Chin says if it ain't broke, why fix it? VP will, he says, simply continue on the path it spent the past 20 years so successfully carving out.
The focus is continuing to focus on reggae, and also we've started to do a little bit more on the soca side. So we want to focus in on the Caribbean music, continue to build that. I think there's a lot more potential for reggae. You know, reggae right now is a tiny fraction of the music market in the U.S. That can definitely continue to grow, but bring it to a wider audience, because I think it definitely has a much broader potential.
And Buju Banton wraps up Leslie Goff's report and this Friday edition of BBC Caribbean Report. More news on Monday morning. I'm Debbie Ransom, saying goodbye from London.